morning, ladies and gentlemen, and my members, and welcome. It's a very honor to be here.
Good morning, and let me just say that this is very important to us, so that it will be worthwhile coming here. This amendment is very important. And I think that I want to start by explaining what happens in the appeal procedure, both on the magistrate's court and on the High Court. You'll know that some criminal cases are dealt with at the magistrate's court level, the district or regional courts. Appeal from those courts goes to the High Court. It may only go to the High Court with leave to appeal being granted by the magistrate. If the magistrate refuses that, the convicted person and apply for leave to appeal to the High Court. Other than an application, generally an application, in which he contains an affidavit by the accused in which he sets up all the facts that are the grounds on which he wants to appeal. It works exactly the same way in appeals from the High Court to the City Court of Appeal. Appeals lie only with the leave of a court, either that court or the City Court of Appeal, and the petition. Nothing starting about it. It's simply an affidavit, sending out the facts, and saying, look, I would like to appeal to the court. Now, the petition to the Supreme Court of Appeal is required to contain the full reasons of the High Court for its decision. And there would, of course, have been an application to the High Court for leave to appeal, which would have been refused by the High Court, and the High Court may give reasons for refusing it, and those must be attached. Those two documents come with the application. Now, I want to make one thing perfectly clear. The amendments here, as it was before, as it will be referred to, does not affect people who are represented by lawyers and their trial. It only applies to people who were represented. So in every case that we are concerned with here, every application for each appeal, there will have been a lawyer who has represented the accused. He will know what is happening. He will know the procedure, and he will undoubtedly have drafted the application to appeal what he's settled. So the prospect that anything that appears in the judgment, that something does not appear in the judgment, which is material, the prospect of that not coming to the attention of the court that looks at the matter is virtually nil. In one case in which an occurred, you must understand how that works. It will appear the grounds upon which the appeal is brought. You'll generally find in the judgment, because the judgment will say why the conviction occurred. Now, judges do not like to be overturned on appeal. So they give their reasons pretty fully. Because they give with this evidence, or that evidence, and that evidence, and that's how I dealt with this evidence, and this is, and so forth. So it will be a full judgment. The application for leave to appeal to him will identify why the accused said that he shouldn't have been convicted. And so the judgment on the application for each appeal will then identify the problem that is set before would be the conviction. But all of that will come before you, and in virtually every case, it is quite apparent for those two documents whether the appeal should be, whether there is a prospect of appeal. All that has to be shown is that there is a reasonable prospect that the appeal will succeed and he will be granted. These petitions in our court come before two days. Some letters, 3 or 4 a week, each month, that have to be displayed. They are generally absolutely straightforward. And in 90% of cases, are dismissed. People in this country who get convicted have to virtually throw themselves at the arms of the police for that matter. But anyway, the fact of the matter is perfectly plain, and there's no difficulty with dealing. If the two judges don't agree, the third judge is called in. Well, sometimes, my practice, if the judge that agrees with me, I say, well, I'm willing to defer you. One judge thinks that there might be an appeal, go ahead. Sometimes, in other cases, you might call in a third judge, and he will decide the matter. But you have before you a clear statement that shows that the person was properly convicted. Now, that was the way the situated position was. It's always been the position in the Supreme Court. Then this amendment occurred. We were never told about this being brought. We were never asked about it. The first time we saw it was when it was already been passed. What this requires now is that in every case in which there is an application for leave to appeal, again, these are only cases where lawyers have represented the party. In every case, a full record of a trial will have to be produced. Now, if you've gone through criminal cases, you will find that if you've sat and tried criminal cases, you will find that a large proportion of the evidence that is given by the end of the trial is uncontroversial. There will be evidence in a murder case, for example. Evidence by a pathologist as to what he found when he did the post-mortem. There will be a whole chain of linking evidence to link that to the particular person. There may be ballistic evidence about what happened with him, what they found in the shop. Some of the time you'll find that nothing is found. So by the end of the trial, there is a small body of evidence, generally, that leads to the conviction. A lot of it has fallen away. The lawyer has conceived of it by the end. He says, no, I can't contest that. So you've got a fairly limited body of evidence. Now, in the application for leave to appeal, you actually have to type all of that, a whole lot, from beginning to end, to put before the judge. Now, you've got to ask yourself, what is the judge going to do when it is quite apparent from the judgment itself that leave to appeal should be granted? He's going to read that with. Well, obviously he's not. Let me give you an example of what can occur. You'll know, I think it's in my memorandum, you'll know that there's this trial been running for Gudemachen, Jesus. It has been running for 8 years. 9 years. We're counting your days. Do you know how long that record is going to be? Yeah. Assume that they, I don't know if they have been convicted, some of them, I think, but anyway, assume they will get convicted for Jesus. And not get sent. Sorry, and they never sent. Now they say, listen, you've got me cold. Look at all this evidence. I can't appeal the conviction. I want to appeal against the sentence of life in prison. Now you tell me, how much of that record would we have to read to decide whether the sentence of life imprisonment for treason would have ever been appropriate? Nothing. The sentence by itself and the crime by itself. They can have as many children as they want. They can lose as many jobs. They've lost them anyway. Whatever happens to that person, the prospect of him being granted, being succeeding in a appeal is remote. But let's assume that there is something that should reduce it to 20 years, 15 years. You have to read the record for that. So what will have happened in that case? The state will have had to type a record of 8 years of trial, 9 years of trial, at $5,000 a page, which you can throw into the bin. That's what this bill will do. The position before the prison. That's what will happen. That's why I say this is so important to us. It is not important to us because I'm not going to read those 9 days of evidence. It's
It's going to arrive and it's going to be thrown into the shredder.
Or some of you come to collect the waste paper.
I'm not going to read it. All that will happen is that the state has paid for that for no purpose whatsoever. Now, one can give many examples
of what might occur. Because you've got to bear in mind, you can force the judge to have his record along with it when he makes the decision. You can't force him to keep it.
So if the record comes, and as it is at the moment, one can decide the application for you to appeal on the affidavit. You're not going to read it, even if you're refusing me. Because if it is apparent from the judgment that there's no prospect to appeal, you're going to refuse it. That's all there is to it. If you're not going to read it. So whether you've got the record typed or not is actually irrelevant. The judge will either read it or he won't. He might read a portion of it or he won't. In any event, as it was before and will be here, a judge is quite entitled to call for any information that he needs. And sometimes, I've done it at times myself, one will call for part of the record because you want to see what happened. You'll call for that part of the record. Well, that gets tied up, it may be 30 pages, and you've saved yourself in years of pages. So it's going to make no difference, one way or the other. Now, you're going to ask me, I'm sure, I'll deal with it now. What happened in this case in which the application for leave to appeal was made, it was refused, the convicted person went up to the other court, and the other court, the constitutional court, said to the effect, what is to be noted about the judgment of the trial court is that it did not describe or discuss its reasons for omitting the statements and pointing down, but merely referred to reasons set out earlier in the record. Well, already he's given himself away. Well, not given himself away. That, don't forget, that was an appeal. If that judgment had been before me, I would have known from the part that is quoted that the conviction was based on confession. And if it didn't deal with the admissibility of the confession, I would call for the record, because I would need it in order to do so. So it's not as if the judge who dealt with the appeal was not aware that there was a relevant factor, not aware of the basis of the appeal. It said so, the judge. He said so in the record. The thing that was missing was only his reasons why he admitted it, and therefore the evidence that he weighed up to it. Why did this occur in this case? I'll tell you why. The lawyers who put the petition before the court did not make issue of the confession. They did not say, I want to appeal because the confession would not have been admitted. If you've got that and you have the record next, you're not going to read the trial within a trial in which the confession was admitted, because it is not one of the grounds on which they want to appeal. But even if that is my, I haven't spoken to the judges, but that's what my colleague tells me. Is the explanation they've given for this. I haven't seen a petition myself. But let me assume for a moment that it had been raised at the time of appeal, and that the judges then didn't have the record. What would they do? They would call for that part of the record that dealt with the admission of that evidence. Whichever way you look at it, there is no prospect at all of the person being refused leave to appeal without the judge knowing the grounds on which they were convicted. Either from the judgment itself, or the judgment will alert them to the fact that they don't have the evidence before. There is no prospect for it. The only thing this bill will do is to make the state type of advisor and defense. In the meantime, though, ask yourself, where is this accused person who wants to appeal? Where is he? He's sitting in prison. And you get away for this record. And after you get a record of 8 years' time, even a record of 2 months, two weeks, the waiting dog for months, he can sit there for a year and more. We have petitions waiting to be dealt with. My last count is 60 petitions waiting to be dealt with because we haven't got the record. And it's not that we're going to read the records when they come. It's just that we have to have them. That's all this says. You must have the record. And what is going to happen, I guarantee you, in most of those cases, when the record comes, The leave to appeal is going to be refused. After that, let him be there. In the meantime, some of those people have been there for more than a year, some close to 2 years. Well, you say, what difference does it make? They're sitting there anyway. Look, some of their sentences will have, you know, might be close to expiration, they might be affecting their parole or whatever. But the point is that a person sitting in jail for 2 years waiting to know whether he can appeal is very aggrieved. He wants to know. He needs to know, and he should know as speedily as possible. Even if he's going to sit there for the rest of his life, he should know that. He should not have to wait for a year or 2 years to know that he's going to stay there. It does not at the moment on our present practice affect those who might receive. Because at the moment we are not complying with the section so far as those who on the paper should be wanted to leave to appeal. Because they're just disposing of it. Saying it doesn't going to make no difference to this accused because he's getting what he wants. No point in waiting for a record because it's going to delay him when it might be let out. So we're not applying this at the moment in those cases. The record is not being offered. We've got 60 to 70 in which, on the face of it, these people will refuse to leave the bill, and the prospect of them getting it is virtually zero. Now, so that's what I say about this judgment. You've got to understand the facts as to how this occurred. And it occurred because the accused legal representative did not say it was a ground on which he wanted to appeal. And if we had had the record with us, he would have said exactly the same thing, and we would have not read it. The fault there lies with the attorney, not with the system at all. The system did not create that problem. It was the way that the attorney or advocate or whoever dealt with the matter for his client. There is no need to put a system in place that can't correct that problem. I suspect that at the end of the day, you might find have found here that he didn't deal with it because he didn't think there was any prospect of succeeding on it. Perhaps it went to another lawyer who said, there's a constitutional point. He didn't have the record, didn't have the evidence, there's a constitutional point. So you go to the court on an abstract constitutional point. Anyway, there it is. Now, the other thing you've got before you is something from the legal aid. I've been through this now, and I've got crosses all over it. The person who wrote this does not know how a system works. I can go through it and tell you all the errors, but he does not know how the system works, and that is littered with errors. Let me take you, do you have it, anyone in front of you? If you take it out and turn to the page 2, we'll start at the bottom of page 1. The changes, they say, made it compulsory in criminal matters for the court to consider a full record. It doesn't say that. It says you must have the record. It doesn't compel you to a judge to read it. And how can you compel a judge to read something that is irrelevant, that you think is irrelevant? Must he have a policeman sitting there and say, read 8 years of evidence to decide whether that man should have gone to prison for life? Of course not. You can't monitor the judge. You've got to trust your judges to do their job. In my experience, judges do their job. I've countless petitions by now. I did them in the High Court, I did them in the, as I say, there 3-4 a week in the SA, and I've been there 12 years. You can count how many petitions I've done. Next, three lines down. It is compulsory, it is no longer compulsory for the judges deciding to have insight into the full record. I don't have to have insight into the record. Nothing can compel me to. I just have to have the record. So there's the, in that paragraph, there's a few references, so forth. The suggestion here is that judges have to read the record. It's not correct. They just have to have the record. If you then turn to page 2, going across the page 3, they talk about this case in which Shingo versus the state. And it is said that the provisions limiting the placement of the records before the High Court in respect of petitions from the magistrates of regional courts were unconstitutional. They were. Do you read for that? Somewhere down a few lines down the head, no difference. There is a fundamental difference. In the magistrates of regional courts, people are not very often certainly the district court, not represented, by the way. In those cases, the same as in the SCA, the builder says the records are good for the district. It always said so. We have the record when we get the petition that is written by the C lawyer in prison, of which there are many, to roughly standard petitions. We have to have the record there, because we can't expect the C lawyer to have it. So this is wrong to suggest that the position is the same. It's the same only in the sense that in those cases that come from the magistrates' court, the High Court, which people are not represented, the cases that come to us from the High Court, in which people are not represented, we have the record in those cases. Let me go then on to they deal again with Shinga paragraph 4 incorrectly. 1, 2, 3, 4. Fifth line to the bottom of page 4. If put into operation, the bill will create a situation where the Supreme Court appeal would be unable to adequately reopen the matter. Quite wrong. We are quite entitled to call for a record at any time. We can call for part of the record, full record. We are quite able to appraise the matter fully by just asking for the record. It doesn't mean we have to have it in every case. Now, if you go to the middle of the following page 5, they say that because you've got to have the record for the appeal, you might then get it for the application for leave to appeal, won't cause any delay. Now, if we were not reaching the Act of Loan, which we are, those people who are probably going to get, who have got a good prospect of being released from prison, are going to sit there for 2 years. Because we should be waiting for those people to get the full record, even though we know we are going to grant the leave to appeal. As the Act is at the moment, we are obliged to wait for the record. We don't do that for the obvious reason that we are going to prejudice this person. Clearly, it's going to prejudice the person for no purpose. Because in that case, we're going to grant the leave to appeal anyway. Well, why do you want to read the record? He's shown already on the judgment why or whether that there might be an error. So that is wrong. Bottom of that page. Thirdly, addresses the fact that if an appeal is against sentence, the entire record is not necessary. It is not an entirely true proposition. In an appeal against sentence, the whole record is still typed in place before the appeal court. Well, that is the appeal. You're talking about the application for leave to appeal. Why should it be typed then, when it might be unnecessary? In the appeal itself, where that is, then you know that the person has already granted leave to appeal. So he's got his appeal. Therefore, you have to have the record. So why do you have to have the record to get your appeal? It doesn't deal with that. This is wrong. And then it goes on to say, it must also be pointed out these three factors are systemic and that you cannot justify it on systemic reasons. The reason that this is no good, it's got nothing to do with the systematic. It's got to do with the fact that it's completely wrong. We are not talking about systemic problem about any thing that's going to affect the accused for systemic reasons. We're saying it is not going to affect the accused one way or the other. It has been like that for years and years beforehand. We wanted to go back to where it was, because if we had told you this at the time, I don't think you would have passed that. And so we just wanted it. Now, there is a second aspect of this bill that you're going to have, and that is hereby assets versus, like we said, you know, retrospectivity parliamentarians. Say, no, don't agree with me. I said to you, but not that. Once you see that it is not possible for this bill to affect an accused, there is no reason for it not to be made retrospective. You're not taking away any rights at all. He's got all the rights that he has. And it's affecting nothing. What it is doing is enabling us that 560 petitions we're sitting with in our storeroom, where the accused are waiting for an answer, are there because these records have been typed at 5 grand a page, and it takes a long time for the subscribers in these places to type records. It's way too long. We want to deal with those people. We want to say to them, either you don't give leave to appeal, which will on the face of happen in all those cases. But we want to tell them that and get the matter out of the way. And we do not want the space to be typing records in 50 cases which are unnecessary. We want it retrospective to save the state money. We don't want it retrospective so that we don't have to read it. We will not read it. I told you why. We will read it where it is necessary to do so, and in that case, we will read it where it, we would have, in cases in which we would have called for it in any case. It makes absolutely no difference. So look, ladies and gentlemen, if you could find in there something that is going to prejudice an accused, well, you better tell me. I can't see it. And I've been dealing with petitions for a long, long time. And if it doesn't affect the accused, it's not going to change what is occurring at the moment. There is no reason not to make it retrospective. Retrospectivity, the problem with retrospectivity is that you take away rights that are proved to people. You go back and you say, you have that right, I go back and I obliterate the right. That is why retrospective legislation is not acceptable. Retrospective litigation, legislation, I can assure you, I would be as opposed as you are to retrospective litigation generally, because it takes away rights. And my job is to, and it has been for years, is not to take away rights, but to enforce rights. Do you think I would see it any differently? I'm asking for it to be retrospective because I know it does not exist. And therefore it is completely irrelevant whether we have those the records in those cases.
Yeah, thanks and apologies for coming late. I was at another meeting. Just firstly, the issue of the lack of consultation. The Judicial Matters Amendment Bill of 2008, the memorandum states that the bill was also made available to the Chief Justice, the President of the Supreme Court of Appeal, all judges, President, Regional Court President, Chief Magistrate. You know, also that the parliamentary process is open. It doesn't mean that this is a bill before Parliament, that the judges of whatever court can't come and make representations to it as you are doing now.
No, I accept it was, it did go there. Certainly I am not wasn't aware of it. Okay.
But anyway, that's just that issue. Look, I hear what you're saying and I'm quite sympathetic to it. And on the retrospectivity issue, I mean, if the aunt rights that are being affected by the amendment that's proposed, well then retrospectivity isn't a problem, so I don't see a problem with that. The issue is, are the rights of accused persons or convicted persons that are affected? And my difficulty is, Shinga and Kringa. And because although Shinga was magistrate's court, the reasoning didn't necessarily relate to magistrate's court. So I'm just looking at Judge Akub's reasoning from paragraph 40. Refers to the O'Connell judgment. This is about, and same things like, I cannot imagine how a petition of this quality absent the record can ever result in an adequate reappraisal. The issue of the prosecution and the accused agreeing, the provision assumes that all accused persons and those who are not particularly competently represented, which may have been the case in Finger, will be able to determine whether a record is required in order to enable the petition judges to determine whether leave to appeal is to be granted. There's no foundation for such a thesis. There can be no justification for this provision either. The issue of sentencing, it's entirely possible that neither the judgment of the magistrate on the merits of the sentence nor the petition would pick up on matters favourable to the accused that would have an effect on sentence. Although he does refer to magistrates there, I mean, you could read in judge. So I think that's the one difficulty. You're not, with respect to the Constitutional Court, who would determine whether this provision is in fact constitutional or not. It's been ruled as unconstitutional from MAJ to High Court. I hear what you're saying, and there is precedent, I think, is it Staines or Renz, I think, that talks about differences between the quality, and we know that, obviously, of magistrates' courts and High Courts. But that's the difficulty. And then the difficulty further with Klinger I don't know if anybody knows what happened to Mr. Klinger and his co-accused, whether they did get an acquittal or anything when their petition was heard. But the difficulty with Klinger is that the record wasn't there. And although there wasn't a ruling on the constitutionality of this very provision that we're dealing with, the effect was that the matter was referred back to the SCA. And so if the provision had been in force, whether it was ruled unconstitutional or not, the matter would have been referred back. That's the difficulty. I mean, you yourselves in your memorandum, paragraph 5, you say the evidence upon which the conviction was founded will almost always be summarized in the judgment of the High Court. So you yourselves with the will almost always admit that there would be times when it's not. But our difficulty, I think, is we're very sensitive to issues of money and state resources, so the transcribing of records is in the cost of transcribing records. Oh, by the way, one other point, sorry, before that, you disagree with legal aid around the fact that the judges aren't compelled to read the records.
Before you go on to the next question, may I deal with one that you gave me?
Everything, and then I'm going to put a proposition to you as well. But anyway, on the compelled to read the record, I suppose the issue is whether the record that's attached to the petition forms part of the petition. Because if it doesn't, maybe that was legal aid's ruling. If it does, then when there's reference to judges considering the petition, it may be that they have to consider the record as well. But anyway, look, the bottom line is that's our difficulty. Match to High Court is quite clearly unconstitutional for Judge Yakub's reasons. Why is it not unconstitutional from High to SCA? Well, the argument seems to be, well, it's because the quality of the High Courts are better. That seems to be the sole argument. The issues of the workload, I don't think, when it comes to rights, to come in as a factor, I don't think they can be used as arguments for taking away rights. So that's the difficulty we've got. That's effectively the problem. The only thing I wondered about as a possible solution, and I don't know what you think about it, is that the provision that you want is that the record is not required in certain cases. Even if the accused representative agrees, well, it could be that the accused representation at the High Court was bad, as it seems was in the case of Klinger. But anyway, the system that you're proposing that was there is you don't require the record, but you can call for it. What about a slightly different...
Yes. Yes. We can call for
yes. 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 Well, at the moment, the record is required. That was the effect of the Judicial Matters Amendment 208. The record is required. So you don't need to call them. The provision related to calling for it is not easy. That was the position it was. Since the 208 amendment, you have to have the record. So there was no need for provision giving you the ability to call for it. My suggestion is, what about slightly different wording? Which is, the record is not required, but if from a reading of the judgment that it is clear that not all the factors are disclosed, you then must call for the record. So in other words, it's not an option, that may have remedied Klinger. Because in Klinger, your learned colleagues felt that although everything was not disclosed, they didn't see the need to call for the judgment, which was within their right in terms of the wording of law at that point. If you have had my proposal, which is if everything is not adequately disclosed, if in the judgment, then you have an obligation, not an option, on the FCA judges to call for it. So that's the suggestion. But I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying. It's just, I don't know how long this will take to get to the Concord, the other court, as you called it. You know, we don't want to be embarrassed.
No, I quite understand that. I want to make one figure.
Judge, the way we usually work, presumably you're just writing notes, but other members will add. That's all.
Yeah, look at this. That's what my notes look like. Because I've got a note like, God, my handshake. So anyway, carry on.
But, this is the way we work with the title section. When the Honourable Jeffrey says we think that we think that he speaks for the ANC, we do not have a pulpit position. I speak for myself. My colleague, the Honourable Schaefer, will ask questions on her own behalf. But we'll see that what I've been thinking while reading last night is not a million miles from the position of the questions the ANC is asking. First, as cost. Can we agree that cost can never in itself be an argument where rights are at issue? And on that point, you do have to concede to legal evidence. Cost to the state can never be an argument against the dilution or infringement of any right. If, and we will discuss that, if the infringement of any rights are at issue in the state. So that is the real question. Cost on its own, R5 a page, doesn't mean a thing to me. If there's a possibility that rights are at issue, can we agree on that? As to constitutionality, I wanted to ask your views on this. The Constitutional Court in Pinda simply didn't reach the question of constitutionality at this level in these courts because it was not necessary because the National Assembly had already passed the amendment. Now, so a question that arises for me is, had that not been the case, how would the Constitutional Court have ruled? Would it have declared unconstitutionality yet again? The answer must presumably lie in saying, at which I only glanced, Renka didn't glance at, but tax advocate better can assist me there also. Is there an answer in Spain? But saying I think we see something where Kunga was 2011. So somebody needs to enlighten me as to how the one played upon the other. As to difficulty here, I'm afraid, as I said when I walked in, that I was entirely sympathetic until I read Kunga. And the difficulty is, quite obviously, now we retrace the same ground, forgive me, the evidence you say upon which the conviction was founded will almost always be summarized in the judgment. It was not in Chica. You say that it can be expected that the legal representative of the accused would draw this to the attention of the judges in the petition, but they didn't. And you, as I understood you, Judge, squarely put the blame upon these lawyers. You argue that in any event, the judges are entitled to call for the record if they consider the judgment to be insufficient, but they didn't. And the result was injustice. But that is what we have to deal with. Kunga therefore had to go to the Constitutional Court. So this is a single case, yes, but it's a single case that demonstrates the possibility of injustice. And therefore there must be a solution. Judge, you said you laid emphasis on the fact that the judges at the FCA can call for the record in the case they did not. So the solution must lie in there somewhere. Let's see if we can find a solution to meet you halfway. But at the end of the day, in other words, they sound very much to me like what the Honourable Jeffrey was arguing. You say they can call for the record, he's suggesting, but we must then create the circumstances where you must call for the record. Is there a way of doing that? You will have an insight in the wisdom to tell us if so, perhaps even suggest wording. May I just say, as to retrospectivity, it's true that it's nothing of a red flag. But as speaking for myself, I talk about tactic retrospectivity when I say that it's a red flag. The idea that you can convict someone for something that wasn't a crime at the time he did the deed or committed it, that's your classic retrospectivity. The other kinds of retrospectivity are to me a far more nuanced picture, and I think there will be different decisions in different cases. In this case, it's a matter of a true crime, and the question quite simply is, these people did accrue certain rights under the 2010 amendment. are, upon your suggestion, being removed. So there is an issue which has to be dealt with. And once again, perhaps, the solution lies in whatever amendment we can come up with to the old provision. Thank you.
You wouldn't need to make notes. Just to say that the suggestion by Mr. Jeffries is something that one could possibly consider seriously. The question being, what rights are being infringed? And you made a lot of emphasis that, in fact, that there aren't rights being infringed, but it seems that Constitutional Court decision holds otherwise. So we definitely are sympathetic and we want to help you. I think that the issue of costs does come to play. One looks at whether the rights are being infringed. I'm relatively persuaded that rights aren't being infringed. But then again, bear in mind what that PCK says. Once that comes into play, we are under huge financial constraints as a department, and we need to consider that once the first question has been answered. Retrospectivity, I don't have a major problem with retrospectivity. But I think that we need to find a way of marrying how we can assist you with what the Constitutional Court has already said. And maybe we need to take a risk and let the court decide at a later stage if necessary. That's the balance we've got to strike at the moment. Thank you, Jane.
And just two brief points. First of all, assuming that we agree that the record of the previous courts together with the attorney's representations in the petition are going to elucidate all the aspects of the evidence that have been raised. What about the case where a person who has had an attorney at trial, but not happened? So the really so would increase, you probably need to cover that possibility. So they might be represented at the case, but now the person is not assisting them in that petition, and they may not be able to cover all the time. And then just secondly, in the point of interest, I mean, you have to show us that you aren't complying with the law at the moment in respect to the record. So why are there 60 cases waiting for records?
I just wanted to answer that question. The reason I was there is because on the face of it, they should be refused. The ones that where we look at the record and say, yes, quite obviously it should be granted, we don't wait for the record. We send it off to go to the appeal. The ones that are waiting there are only those in which we would ordinarily refuse. The ones that are waiting there are also ones that I can say with confidence will be refused. Because on those cases, the judges, two judges, have already looked at them and said, we should refuse this petition. And there is nothing in the petition or the judgment or whatever that would make them think they should call for it. The basis of 60 that is there, you can accept. As soon as we get the records, they're all going to be thrown into the records will be thrown away. The 60 petition will be refused. And the fellow sitting waiting for 2 years to know if he's going to have an appeal will be called back. So I think that's it. Such matters, service, you're quite right. I would accept without hesitation that if someone's rights are going to be taken away, I would not for a moment suggest that it's too expensive to do so. My whole proposition to you is that rights are not being taken away. I also now say to you, suggest to you that this is not a right that accrues to the accused. It's simply an administrative direction to the rest of it. That's all. So, but look, but you see the problem with the I'm going to come to you at the end. I'm just trying to get to all these points. And you know, just to be deceptive, it's very ironic, isn't it, that the person who sent me here to persuade me to allow it to judgment. Yeah, judgment beyond is the deputy judge, deputy president of our court, and he said, please, you and Judge Charlie, go to Peckham. I'd rather not have an appeal yesterday, but one tomorrow. He said, please, there,
No, he just doesn't think that, it's, that there's a conflict there. You know, when it comes to the admission of a confession in a criminal case, you have what is called a trial within the trial. So it's a separate inquiry entirely as to the admissibility of that. I call the magistrate, so I took the confession, the policeman, or whatever it is. So you have that, you decide it's admissible or not, and then you go on to the trial. So on that case, all that was required was the evidence of the trial within the trial, not the evidence of the whole trial. Because once it's admitted, that's the end of it. So all that would have been required, there had it been required, which I think it was required myself, but just reading that, like I haven't seen the petition, would be that small part of the evidence. And that takes me to the point raised by Mr. Jeffrey says that we acknowledge in our thing here that when we say almost all, that this bill is required. The answer is no. This case was a case in which it was required. And this case is a case which had appeared from the judgment. That's what the judge said. He quoted the passage. And he said, because of that, the way the court had dealt, because they said, I convicted on a confession, and there is no evidence in the petition of the bill, or in the judgment of what, whatever, then the petition even called for record to get there. But that was the case in which the evidence did not appear in the judgment. But the fact that there was such evidence that was lacking appeared in the judgment. And so you obtain that case. He says he convicted on a confession. If the admissibility of that confession is an issue at all, he said that I haven't got the evidence of what happened in the trial with the crime. He called for it. So it's not correct to say that my almost justifies the bill. I say almost covers this kind of case. But I would have known that he was convicted on a confession. And if there were any suggestion by him, that he's a lawyer for that matter. Well, a sea lawyer would have had the record anyway. But if a sea lawyer had sent me a petition, I would immediately have gone to the record to read the evidence in the trial of the trial. Because that sea lawyer has got no idea whatever that evidence was in the first place. And it doesn't appear in the judgment. So I must go to the record again. You cannot give me one example. And I show Mr. Jeffries does his very best, and that's the best he can do. You cannot give me one example in which an accused will be prejudiced in the present situation. And I challenge any of you to this. I will answer every single question that you've made. You won't be able to think of one. That's right. I wish that I'd realized this was the problem. I would have brought the petition to see what happened. There are one or two possibilities. One is that they weren't alerted to the fact, which is the one they suggest I'm told by my group. They weren't alerted to the fact that the admissibility of the evidence was an issue. In other words, you get a petition, it says you have convicted on this confession. It says nothing about objecting to the admission of the confession. So now the petitioner himself saying to you, I accept the right to admit. Why do you need to read the record? If his affirming this if you accept that this right he admitted. Is there any reason why I should go and go and question his attorney and say, no, Mr. You know, you're not dealing properly with your time. I'm going to read the record to see that every point you make is correct. Of course I'm not going to. That's why. Otherwise, why bother with the lawyer? Are you allowed to interrupt me?
See, with that is that, as in Shinga and paragraph 42 and Yakub's judgment, you know, the reference to, you talk about sea lawyers, but the reference to those who are not particularly competently represented. So I think from the constitutional court, from Shinga, the proposition was that having the prosecution and the accused agree is not a good ground because there may not be good representation. That was definitely the case. Well, Yakub was referring to the magistrate's court, but you could have a not particularly competent, I'm sure you would agree, not a particularly competent representation at the High Court level.
You're quite right. By the way, I'm talking about the sea lawyer. I'm talking about the guy who sits in prison, and there are those spies there, who writes petitions for guys who can't write or whatever. And he knows he can say section so of the Constitution gives me a right to fair trial and things like that. That's the sea lawyer problem. But I said to you at the beginning, and I must repeat it, this has no application at all when a person is not represented in the High Court in his trial. In his trial, if he's not represented in the trial, the record comes as a matter of fact. No, but can I just finish the sentence? At least I'm not going to at least finish the sentence here. That's right. But that's why the PIA sent him down to just make sure he's upset. But now you've got a point. So now, but you now talk about land representation. You know, I'll tell you something. Where does one end? I can't protect a man against his own lawyer. I can't, I choose them. Look, Sidney Kentridge represented this man. But you know, Sidney, I would look, check on him as well. Little man in the, you know, guy just joined the bar, represented him. Well, where do I check on? Well, I check on all the lawyers. I think, Mr. Jeffrey, I'm not being facetious now, I'm just saying that I think that once one accepts the principle that a qualified lawyer is admitted, is entitled to represent one, I don't think one can say that you might be, if there's injustice there, it's because of the attorney. You can't expect the judges to override the attorney. You see, the judge may not. This man has appointed that person as his advisor, not me.
The issue of poor representation is a real problem in our court, but that is not a problem peculiar to the petition. I will tell you that there are people who lawyers who have been appointed to the appeals court who will sit and listen to for a half an hour, and we will acquit an accused despite, not because of the poor representation. He let the person off after having spent 12 years in jail. His lawyer was absolutely not helpful at all. And we found there were problems in the record of the rape conviction that they relied on medical evidence which was not enough. One man spent 12 years, we let him go. That was because, as I said, it was despite his losing reputation. So that problem frequently arises. When we do have, and my colleague has not conveyed the impression because you have a poorly drafted petition, you are bound by it. We often go right behind, we know what the poor lawyer has said. We look very carefully at the judgment, because we realize that petitions are often of a very poor quality. That is the truth. And we then scrutinize the judgment very, very carefully. And I can assure you that having gone through that process, we frequently give leave on questions that hasn't been raised in the petition.
I want to finish your points because I want to come to the major one, which is an appropriate time to do so of what you think. Because there's nothing wrong with the proposal. Good sort of upper. I find it, and I'm not being rude, I'm not thinking, I find it offensive. And I'll tell you why I find it offensive, for the reason that he says, you've got to trust your judge. If you say the judge is obliged to be there, you've got no way that you can be sure that he does. If you've got a bad judge, you've got to. If you've got a good judge, you will read it anyway. And I don't think one should be saying to a judge, that's how you must do your work from the legislative side. You've got to rely on judges to do their work, and you rely upon me to do your work. You know, once one starts doubting that people in high office are not doing their work, I mean, you want to close up the shop. So you can't compel him to read it, that's the point. Now, it may look nice for you if you want to go and present him while it is whatever. And I know you people have got your own problems politically and so forth. So it may look... if you want to, I mean... can I just finish? I mean, I'm allowed that. So that's one of my problems. It's not going to cause a problem. But it is not going to solve it. It's not going to be... It's not going to make any difference at all. And Judge Gedalia has said that, and I want to assure you, in our court, judges are diligent and they do their work. There are many cases in which the people are saved by the judge against their will because they do their work. And so I just don't think that one should do that by myself. If you're going to get rid of it, then get rid of it. But don't replace it with something which appears to give the right, which is not there. Because I keep saying, all you can do is compel the legislator to put the record in front of us. You cannot compel us to read it. Now, don't say that as a challenge to you. Please don't misunderstand. I'm just telling you what the effect of the bill is. If it's a proper judge, he will read it, and anybody would have read in any of it. If it is a not proper judge, you can't say the person from the judge is not a proper judge.
So the point I was going to make before Judge Italia interrupted me and then you wouldn't let me speak. I hear what you're saying relating to the quality of representation, but the point though is that's not what Judge Aku accepted in Shinga. Okay, that's the worry. Now he wants to interrupt me.
That was what I meant to deal with, but my notes and I couldn't go. You know, I think I haven't read it recently, but I was around when the Wren and Spain was it those days. Mm-hmm. I was around in the High Court at that time where we had you get petitions from the magistrates. If I remember correctly, Judge Lippott in one of those cases specifically said the same problem doesn't arise in the SCA because they are implicated. That is my very strong recollection, because at that time we had asked the question of what happens, you know, if they go to the SA, but it was dealt with in one of those. There is a recognition there that there is a difference between the two. You will find it in one of those judges. Look for the one that's proper. Find it. So what Justice Yacoub says, you say, what Justice Yacoub says here, you can say, well, what he said is equally applicable. But it actually isn't, and the Constitutional Court recognized that in that area. I don't think you've got any problem with constitutionality. I really don't.
You're right. But then I think going back to Mtiane, I mean, you know, your response to my suggestion around a requirement that that judges must, instead of an option, a requirement that they must call for the judgment or sections of the judgment if the grounds are not adequately reflected in the lower judgment. I mean, the fact of the matter is, which you said was offensive, the fact of the matter is that the SEA erred in Klinger, which is why it was sent back. Okay. The SEA refused leave to appeal, refuse the petition, and your current deputy judge president, when he was an acting judge of the Constitutional Court, with whole court concurring, ordered that the order of the FCA dismissing the applicant's petition for leave of appeal is set aside. The petition is remitted to the FCA for reconsideration. So that is the fact of what happened. And it was, the court didn't need to look at the constitutionality of that provision because it had been repealed, but the FCA considered the petition in the light of that amendment in light of what is the 309C of the Criminal Procedure Act. And my point is really, and I suppose is that this amendment that you find offensive that I'm suggesting should have resulted in then finger not happening. Because the judges then should have seen that, look, the trial court doesn't discuss the grounds on which the evidence was challenged, nor does it discuss the grounds on which was admitted. Therefore, we must call for the judgment, rather than what was in 309C was that you may call for the judgment, and then maybe it would be an issue of not the entire record, but sections of the record, whatever, or information, or something like that. So, I don't know. I mean, obviously one doesn't want to be told by a Supreme Court of Appeal judge that a proposal is offensive and have an offensive proposal. But, so obviously we must, as the committee, look at that. It's a question just of would it assist, because to my mind it would have ensured that Klinger would not have happened.
Yeah, if I understand your complaint, you've got a case where there is any judgment. But the point is that it didn't occur because the record was not there. It occurred because no one read it. That's the problem. And that's why I keep saying that you're going to incur a lot of cost, let's say, with it actually achieving nothing. Because those judges, if they erred, if they didn't read it, that judge, they wouldn't have read the petition. Why would they have? You can't expect judges, in every case, to read the whole record so as it were, retry the case. Can we have a debate on this backward and forward, whatever your procedures are, so that we can just stick to this, because that is where the problem is.
But look, the Concord judges, presumably didn't read the record either.
No,
there's a reference in your current deputy JP's judgment of that. So they picked up.
No, you're wrong.
Huh?
No, you're wrong. The judges in the concourse did not have the record. They did not have the record. The SEA did not have the record. They were both in exactly the same position when they read this petition, because they both read the same petition. The SEA judges. Concord judges. They both read this petition. Neither had records. But what happened is that they saw here, if you read this passage that he's got in this judgment, just go and read this passage at page 3-4 of the judgment. Do you have it?
Yeah.
See the passage at the top. What is being quoted for, what that is an extract from the judgment before our court and before the chief. In other words, the judge said would have been attached to the petition. Now, the other judge who finds the person guilty says the servants were robbed, etc. The state relies on statements and some points out the accused made in which they implicated themselves. Trials within a trial were held. Rulings were the statements and the pointing out where were admissible in evidence. There he said, a trial is like, but he doesn't tell you what the evidence is within the trial. You see the difference? So that's why the evidence was there. The court knew that it was a conviction on evidence, but the evidence didn't appear from the judge. What would have appeared in the rest of this judgment of the court below is then, well, sorry, in this case,
in other cases, what will appear is the reason why conviction occurred. Here he's simply saying the conviction occurred as a consequence of a separate trial that I held, and I don't tell you what that evidence is. This is a difficulty. Now, the very fact that this book, CC, was able to send it back is because it could see from the petition that there was no evidence to support it. The judges of our court should have done so. Perhaps no, there are no problems, but they would have done so even if the record had been sitting in the rest of them. Because they would have been in no, you know, they would have made the same decision. They would have mistaken the fact. I don't know what they did. I don't want to be unfair to them, but at worst for them, these judges made an error which they would have made anyway. Do you understand what I mean? And so it doesn't, that is not overcome by your will. They made an error. But it's not an error, cannot be solved, would not have been solved by this will. And errors occur in court. And an error might occur again from judge. It will not be solved by will. It was only solved because the judge makes an error.
Well, I mean, I understand that despite what we said here, that you may, I mean, part of your bias is that the matter may come before one or two judges, about here what my colleague has said about trust, but that they would still not call for the record in those particular circumstances when they ought to have. If despite what we've said, you are inclined to the view that some sort of an amendment is necessary, then I would suggest that you are quite careful in your use of language. I mean, you may, for example, want to say something, right? When it appears that justice requires that a copy of a record or portion of the record is necessary for the just determination of a petition, that the judges involved shall call for a copy of the record or those portions of the record which are necessary. So that does not impose an obligation, but the judge looks at that, the judge knows that he or she has discretion in this matter, that they must always consider what is in the interest of justice, what's the proper way of dealing with the petition. And if necessary, they should then be obliged to call for and that their record or portions of the record that may be necessary. As I say, I don't think it is necessary because I think this deals with it. But as I say, despite it, you know, despite our submissions, if you are inclined, don't actually force an entire record on us because it really would be ridiculous. I'm assuming most of the records that we get are only in criminal matters, in all matters. You know, judges understand that, volumes 1 to 4 are entirely irrelevant. The advocates put it in because they're a bit anxious about it. But only the legal point emerging in volume 5 of 3 pages is relevant for this particular appeal. But we simply, as my colleague said, we don't read 4 volumes of nonsense. And if you want us to read it, that's fine. This will happen. We simply cut down the number of appeals we hear because it will no longer be possible for us. It will no longer.
You want a time left to appeal.
Time to appeal.
You see what? I must be careful to distinguish between an appeal court from a trial court. A trial court must hear every part of it, irrelevant or not. He must hear all of it. We are an appeal court, and it's a fundamental difference. My colleague is right. We receive an appeal record that high, of which one volume. And only one body should do it by anyone in the court. So, and the same will happen here. And I think Mr. Jefferson, I mean, my colleague said, put it in, but it actually is there already. And that's why I said, just, you know, look, don't worry about it, you offend me, I'm regarding it. but put it in, but it's there anyway. And,
thanks, Chris. This is very gentle. I don't know if the number of cases will go down. And to say, probably maybe what that is to be looked at is how we come around a huge amount of records that needs to be raised. I think the argument is similar to saying why certify access to justice because of COVID. Why should we now think that when there is too much work, then cases need to be compromised? So body sensitization means maybe moving forward to also looking at cost systems, how we actually model our cost systems in such a way. We don't have to refer to the situation where nations are going to be dealt with new processes that would actually have to improve retitling advice when it's a case which would actually lead to high causes that actually articulate. What it means here is that we need to look at systems, how to step up the system in order for this amendment if we're going to actually come to a situation where we say people need to work out. Because basically it comes from a situation where it's concerned about the energy and mental actually being represented. And of course we agree. In life there will be errors. And we do trust the decision. But the fact of the case, errors happen for one or other reason. And there's got to be a system that actually helps to tie those knots. Because here we're talking about fairness, we're talking about a process that will actually involve people's lives. And if somebody has got to, for example, be taken to prison for the rest of their life, it must be for a reason that everybody would realize that the right to legitimate and pluralism that actually makes the situation to actually look like this. There shouldn't be under mental health.
So I just want to address my issue about people who are presented at trials now, not the medical people. Are you getting it?
No, well, you've got to remind me. I really, I was quite serious. I can't remember all these things. I'm not a note taker. Really, I'm a listener rather than a note taker. I just want to say three things that are very important. And I'm quite frankly, I'm going to leave Judge Kachalik to do that. Because I don't want to speak anymore. I want to say three very important. They are very, very important to me. One gets the impression that people think that we're saying don't want to add in the word. It's not that at all. It's not meant to add words. I'm sorry that my colleague, in that description suggests that we're going to, it's not going to change things at all. We will hear it in the appeal. We will read the petitions. We are just not going to be reading irrelevant records. Now, if you want me to read irrelevant records, you can't force me, and I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to read the whole Boerenbach trial to decide whether they should be sentenced to life in prison. You can put whatever you like. I will not do it. I'm not going to spend 5 years of my life reading a trial for no purpose. So you can't expect that. You can't expect me to do what is not required for my job. And I don't know that you can tell me how to. So it doesn't affect me. I'm not suggesting that this is in some way making us work hard. That's the first thing. The second thing, when it comes to pages, leave that open. I don't care less whether the government has 5 red. I thought I'd raise it because you people are more concerned about wasting government money. It doesn't matter to me one bit. You can fail as much as you like. It doesn't affect my life. I'll tell you what worries me. I am worried about those people, the 60 people, that are in jail.
I could just raise, try and respond to the point earlier, because I do have a sense that that members of the committee are genuinely sort of anxious that how we deal with rights in a cavalier way. It's quite clear. An accused person or somebody who's been convicted has no right to a record. You have a right to a fair trial. You have a right to a fair appeal. You have no right to a record. So no rights are being added to or subtracted from here. So let's just, when we talk about rights, let's not use the language of rights loosely. There is simply no right to a record that there simply can't be. And excuse me, it's a blue something common that does that. I think that the related problem was that if there's a systemic issue around the record, then we mustn't deal with it, you know, around the question of cost. And I think my colleague has pointed out very, very clearly that there is no systemic problem without the record, without us being obliged to have a record. But if you force the record on us, it simply delays systemically the entire system. In fact, I'll tell you, you know what happens, just so you understand practically the way that this happens. The petition comes initially to us with a judgment. We look at it quite quickly and we say, all right, there seems to be no merit in this. But anyway, there's nothing we can do about this now because the law requires us to have a record. So what we do is we send the petition that we have dealt with. We send the petition and the judgment back into the registrar's office. And we then say to the registrar, please get the record. Require these people to act. The registrar sends it off and we wait 2 or 3 years. It then comes back. The same two judges may not be there, the one may be on long leave or whatever. So when the record comes back, there's an entirely new process that would have been gone through. And by the way, I can't remember a record after 4 or 5 weeks completely gone. You know, we have our own hard drive, you just press delete and you're done. You press delete, otherwise you have overload. So when it comes back, it means that you are reconsidering every matter because you're waiting for the record. And that is that process which takes 2 or 3 years where you could have sorted out in 2 hours. So don't cause unintended consequences. Where instead of because you want to improve the system, you create such systemic blockages that it's entirely counterproductive. And that's all I ask you to consider.
Just this, I said at the beginning, there are only two costs. One is cost, and everyone else is about 500 bucks a month, or a cost. But it is the accused, he is waiting for 2 years, and the fact that he's going to have his appeal refused doesn't matter. He sits for 2 years, waiting in the hope he's going to appeal. You can't see people. I'm sorry, Michelle, but just remind me of a question.
The issue of when a person is represented at trial, but not when the petition is lost, so the attorney wouldn't then be an attorney who might be able to pick up on issues that should be raised in the petition.
All the legal aid system, all the petitioners, not the same person, you're quite right. But again, it goes back to your same position as you've got a judgment, and if the judgment shows that you couldn't get leave to appeal, you're not going to read the letter. It shows that you need to read everything you think is still be good. So it goes back to saying,
the issue there is if there is a person. I mean, are there no cases ever where a person is represented at trial, but not when the petition is lodged? Because should we not make provision for that?
No, there are some cases. There are some cases like that. I can't say this.
Just to say that the value of the petition itself, or poorly, Mr. Jeffrey's point, of a poorly represented, when it comes on, you know, with the legal representative or without the legal representative, we consider it our duty to scrutinize the judgments very carefully of the High Court, regardless of what appears in the petition. And especially, I must tell you, in the case where it is somebody just set for 8 years in jail, he's sick and tired of this. He now decides he's going to get one of his buddies to drop this petition. So it comes through. Well, we know that it's an absolutely hopeless document. You can't look at it. But we will examine the judgment very carefully. We'll go back 8 or 9 years to see what the judgment says. And we'll deal with it on that basis. So, to answer your question pertinently, in practice, the distinction can be presented litigant at the petition stage and the poorly represented litigant at the petition stage is really not a distinction in substance at all, because we will approach the matter the same way. We will get the judgment very carefully. We will see if the judgment on conviction and sentence is assailable, or if there's flaws in the reasoning, or there's a charge that they disregard some evidence, and we'll deal with it on that basis. Well, I should say, when a judge, and that you should ask the Judicial Service Commission, because when you appoint a judge to an appellate court, that judge ought to have a track record of hard work, of scholarship. And if you are concerned that there are now weaknesses in the system because judges in appellate courts are making mistakes, then you don't look to us. Then you look to the Judicial Service Commission and you say, are you people appointing the right people to do this job?
Do clarify, so you're not suggesting that we should make provision in the bill for unrepresented youth at the petition stage?
No, I think it would be superfluous.
Judge Newton's last point which came after that he wasn't speaking more. Sorry. But those factors though also apply to the High Court considering petition. The fact that they could dispense with a petition, see there's no basis, no chance for a petition succeeding without having to get a judgment. That's one of the arguments and the issue then of accused having to sit in custody because of the volume of work. Those also apply though to petitions to the High Court from the Magistrate Court.
Good degree.
Is there a difference in volume? I mean, let's say the bigger courts, KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, Western Cape, how many petitions do those High Courts have? I mean, your 60, is that a year or is that just accumulated over how long?
Well, presumably since this bill came into operation, there's many people on this. Yeah. I mean, it would have been started immediately because you must bear in mind most petitions get refused. Everyone that was refused from the time that wouldn't be refused from the time this came into operation.
You don't know how many petitions the High Court of one of the big High Courts would have?
No, I don't know, but I just want to go back and understand that in the High Court you are getting you're getting judgments from the district courts here. Sometimes the magistrate's judgments are very good. So you're generally getting a higher quality judgment now, which does make a difference. And as far as the petitions that come from the prisons there, you're in the same position, but you know, if we've got petitions from prison, we get the records the same way. So I'm not sure that the magistrate's court is the right comparison. That's different from you.
John, if I could just add one point. And I mean, this is, and I'm racist, honestly, I'm not doing this game. If you come to the conclusion that we need that record, I must say you have to then arrive at that conclusion for the Constitutional Court to. You see, I mean, this amendment directed at the SCA makes absolutely no sense, because the same fellow who's sitting there who says this has been turned down properly in the SCA will then send it to the Constitutional Court. And by the way, they don't sit with two judges considering petitions. 11, or at least 9, if one or two are leave, consider everything. So there would be no rational basis with respect for the Constitutional Court to hold the procedure unconstitutional in relation to the SEA and not for itself. That I think absolutely positive. So bear that in mind. That you can't actually make this amendment valid only for the SCA. Unless you then, the only basis to say that many mistakes are faced, you're a weak court. The judges we appointed are poor, and that is why you need it. And I'm raising that as I say, I don't want to escape, but that is the natural consequence of requiring, of ignoring these.
Okay. No. If we're going on to the 17th, should I request Mr. DeLonge to be here? Yes. I can just give him a call.
They've given their memo, which I presume we've read. I don't know then if one should give the opportunity of throwing questions or whether we want to allow Judge Petralia to do a brief summary.
Look, we were prepared. I mean, I remember giving you the memo. You've been through at least some debate, and I understand that a lot of you have different views, or you haven't made up your mind. So if there are some specific questions arising from your earlier debate that you think has not been adequately covered in our submission, then I'd be very happy, and my colleagues would be very happy.
Okay, and the issue basically is that we are going to go with the extended jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court. So the Constitutional Court would no longer be limited to constitutional and related matters. So having done that, why is it necessary? One has to sort of add, and I apologize for it, the words, and particularly if you're overburdened with reading records. Sorry, silly. No, if the Constitutional Court then has a wider jurisdiction, obviously, the more times a matter is heard, the more courts hear a matter, presumably the better decision you get, the more it gets aerated. But given that in labor matters and competition matters, there is a requirement of urgency for a resolution of the issue, there's no point in ordering the reinstatement when 3 years have gone by or 5 years have gone by and people have been employed in that position, there are no jobs there anymore, or the company's gone bankrupt or whatever. Why is it necessary to have the FCA looking at these matters? The memo raises the point that actually you look at very few. There's a sort of chart given of the number of appeals that you considered, and then I think the point is made that you know the test is quite stringent, and you actually hear very few appeals from both courts, appeal courts. But the point, though, is that everybody, while you're considering whether you're going to consider the appeal, everybody's got to wait for the FCA to do that. And that delays things further. And then I think the other aspect is that, look, I mean, you're in some of the appeals that you have overturned the Labour Appeal Court and the Competition Appeal Court, I think in at least one case in which from each court you've then been overturned by the Constitutional Court. And it's really just a factor of yes, I think going on to costs and things like that, it would be a better system if the FCA, the section did not continue in the amendment bill, that the FCA it remained as it were. But given the need for expediency, given then also the Constitutional Court jurisdiction is extended, it's easier for the Constitutional Court to hear matters. They don't have to look for it being a constitutional or related matter.
Why should the FCA still consider these appeals from the Labour Appeal Court and the Competition Appeal Court?
Had to consider whether appeals would come to our court. The only reason that those appeals come to our court is because we got these appeals, and people said we've got a right to go beyond the Constitution. And we were forced to say, yes, you have got that right. But we went to great pains to say, you're not going to get here very often. So that's why that happened at the moment. I wanted to speak myself and don't consider me to be speaking on behalf of the judge. I agree with you. But there are some cases in which deal with more technical issues than constitutional issues. Technical issues under the statute. They're not constitutional, they're interpreted issues of what they come from the Labour Court. Now, our court is a very efficient court. And the appeals come there very quickly. You get our court 3 or 4 months. You'll get a judgment within a month. And in most respects to a constitutional court, it takes a long time to get this. And it can take a year to get a judgment. So on these technical cases, which don't actually require the constitutional court, there is room to say, look, they should be able to come to us when the Labour Appeal Court or the Competition Court is clearly not right. But to push them through to the constitutional court may not be desirable. It might be the kind of case that under their extended jurisdiction they would not have taken in any case. You with me? But there is an error that needs correction. But it doesn't raise anything of great significance for anyone. So my answer to you is, it's debatable. But I wouldn't have any problem if that took them away. I don't want to make good people. That's where they were supposed to stop. That was the statute. For better or worse, that's where they should stop. Same with the competition cases. That's what Parliament said, that's where they should stop. We were just forced to bring them to us.
Thank you for that. As you say, you have to take American National Soda Ash because you had to take it. Because they had a lawyer who was shrewd enough to spot the fact that the Competition Act had ignored the constitutional provision 168. And the reason the lawyer did it, if I may quote from David Lewis' wonderful book, Seeds at the Dinner Table, their lawyer was told David Lewis that the case well managed can last forever. They managed to drag an incontrovertible cartel case through every court in the land for 10 years, whereupon in fact conceded, hours before the conclusion of the final trial before the tribunal, precisely what they had been accused of in the case. And in the field of competition, that is exactly what you do not want. But and then there were further, so I'm thankful for Newton's observation. We do have a caucus position on this because the Democratic Alliance is very serious about making competition law work in this country. And it applies also to the Labour Court. And one of course, and I'm responding now not to you, but to the memorandum. The point is that there have been so very few cases. But the consequences have been so very great of even one of the two competition cases taken. Because as a result of the FCA requiring, for example, initiation documents require the specificity of a supplement, that's Woodland Dairy, and in Sinvest, that you cannot charge somebody and eventually convict them on the kind of basis that the competition authorities work. But those terms are entirely inapposite, as the Constitutional Court said later, in a majority judgment, granted that the majority simply sends the thing back to either the tribunal or yourself. You don't talk in terms of charges, convictions, and summonses under competition authority law. And that is consequences have been very great. Again, Mr. David Lewis will tell you that it has had a restrictive effect. Woodland Dairy in particular has had a restrictive effect on what the competition authorities could achieve. So to me, the fact that there have been so very few is not in itself an argument when the consequences were great. May I ask your view on something? The Honourable Jeffrey introduced the subject. We are adjusting the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court. We have not finalized but we are expanding it beyond the idea of simply constitutional matters, which in my view is artificial. In any case, there is no distinction between constitutional matters and others. And what we are going to do is to add to jurisdiction arguable points of law of general public importance as a test. Now, for other matters. Myself, I don't want it bifurcated at all between constitutional and other matters that we're interested. What I want to ask you is this. In that ANSAC case, you introduced a special filter, a special stringent test before, as you've just said, Judge, you would take competition cases, which we thought was just the right thing. And you said that, but can you refresh our memory on what that test was? Because on my notes from the researchers' work, it said firstly there must be more than a reasonable prospect of success. Secondly, there must be an issue to justify your taking this. A matter of very great importance to parties or of general public importance. Now, the latest memorandum from the SCA doesn't cite the text in that way. So I'm just like to be clear. I've called for the actual judgment so I can see what the text is. Unless you tell me that you've adjusted the text over time. How is the text now applied in the very few days that you get? And if the idea of public importance was one of those, what were the hurdles you set before you would take an appeal from the CAC? And if since we are going to give the Constitutional Court arguable points of law to public importance, surely that would add to the simple logic of sending appeal from the CAC straight to the Court.
You needn't persuade me that, as I say, but that's for my colleagues. I'm not speaking for them. And I might, Judge Kachali must see a different view. But let me just say that as far as that, what you say is that you extend the bill, quite frankly, it's additive. They take what they want. You know what I mean? So what do they say? Their test is it's interest and success, whatever they want. Put in what you like. They're going to take whatever they want. They're going to say, oh, don't give this to you. I think this whole debate. It was a debate, you said, if the Constitution initially would look at the German model, which they took it to. Well, that court by itself has, and I say it, it's slowly taken more jurisdiction under its operation. It's not the top court. So there's a big reach to stay for a point.
Let me say, I'm
not confident
that. I'm going to represent the view of the court. My colleague is obviously entitled to represent his own view. I think we've made it quite clear from the FCA that we are opposed to the, for all the reasons we've given, and I don't have to go through it again, we are opposed to the Constitutional Court assuming German jurisdiction. Whatever they may do now, the fact of the matter is that what was envisaged in the Constitution was that the Constitutional Court would be efficient. The idea that, well, all matters involve the Constitution is in fact not correct, because from the earlier judgments of the Constitutional Court and in other jurisdictions like the United States and elsewhere, they are quite clear that there are constitutional issues and there are other issues. And where a court can decide or dispose of a matter without it implicating the Constitution, it is obliged to do that. That's the doctrine of constitutional avoidance. If you decide, and it seems that you have decided, then I think that the test, and it only makes sense, that the test for what the Constitutional Court should deal with, because it will no longer then be a constitutional court, it will be an appeal court, it will be in fact a Supreme Court of Appeal. All right. But why are you stuck with anything? You are the lawmaker, so you're not stuck with anything. If you don't need, for example, an appeal court or a Supreme Court of Appeal, then have the gut to do away with it. No, but it's not a question of anybody's personal egos. It's a question of what is in the best interest of the country and the public. So don't think to your assistant and think, let's give a bit to this one, and let's give a bit to that one, and let's make that one happy, and let the whole system work a bit unsystematically. That's not what I'm here for. I'm here to tell you what is the best, what I think is in the interest of justice and what's the best possible solution. So our first instance is that we should not. If you are going to have a test, then I think the threshold should be that there must be a matter of, in addition to a constitutional matter, a matter of compelling public interest. Okay? I don't think they should deal with every question of law of legal interpretation. Your ordinary statute or contract require judges to interpret a contract or a statute. And if you lose in the SEA after two or three judges have considered it in the High Court, another five judges have considered it in an appeal court, and the matter is not of a compelling public interest, why do you want to send it one step further? By the way, all matters are very important to the litigants. So if you include a matter of great importance to the litigants, well, that's every matter that goes there. So I would say that the threshold must be high, and that the 11 judges that are taking the matter, they must apply their minds the way a U.S. Supreme Court would apply its mind to say this is a matter of compelling public interest. And you deal with it.
May I just say that I agree with you. I'm just saying the Constitutional Court has taken upon itself more and more things. I don't think it is entitled to do so.
Yes, well, I think in relation to that, I find it, you know, you are not applying your mind to competition matters, so you said it about that. But you know the intellectual property, the tech, there's all of those sorts of matters. Why must those matters then go from, say, three judges in a high court or a tax appeal court to us? And the other matters not. Well, is it because you regard labor and competition as somehow more important? Let's say I have no personal interest. But I think that when you design a constitutional system where you say that there are high courts, that there are three judge appeals, there are five judge appeals, and there are 11 judge appeals, why you then, in some cases, say three judge appeals can go straight to the constitutional court, and other three judge appeals must go to the appeal court? I just find no proper rational basis. If you want to make a straight cause policy decision, that's your prerogative as Parliament. But it makes no deal.
The argument is that competition matters based upon economic thinking, which is not the same at all. That is the difference. A label I wouldn't that is the argument. I've been checked
that. When you say economic thinking, I don't understand what the point is. Sorry, but what is the point about economic thinking that we don't have specialists in the FCA, or what is the point?
And of course, that is exactly why competition authorities and the stock driving laws are often stopped with economists as a test tool. Our Competition Act, in fact, wanted economists appointed to the FCA, the JFC.
All right, well, now that you raise the matter, well, let's face that square off. What on earth gives anybody the idea that the Constitutional Court is an economist there? Which, tell me, one judge was an economist. And so I promise you that there are several judges in our court who have in fact sat in competition matters and have more experience than some of my colleagues in the Constitutional Court. So be quite clear, you're making a policy decision, you're not making a rational decision. It's a clear, it's a positive decision, which then I get back and I accept that. But these arguments that my colleague Davis has put forward about the great expertise in some courses, it's just not correct. And by the way, if you don't have expertise, then the next time, by the way, it's coming up in April, when the Judicial Service Commission sits, then it looks for a judge who, and you ask questions of the next judge. Do you have any training or experience in competition-related matters? And see what the JSC says. Then the JSC must start
the appeal court with people with appropriate skills, general skills, appropriate skills, so that you have a balance of all skills in each court.
The difference with the taxant and with the question of time expediency was more fresh for decisions and competition matters. And then with labour, we've got the appeal court already. So I think we don't need to go. I think we've heard enough on the issue. I mean, as you know, that at one stage, the version of the constitutional amendment and the Superior Court Bill was collapsed. All the specialist courts into one. So we may be arguing a little bit about what Judge Nugent said. He knows us with what we do, a little bit of this or whatever. But anyway, no. Okay. But the point I wanted to make was just that we, as far as the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court, we've gone largely for the British wording, which is an arguable point of law of general public importance, and they added which ought to be considered by that court. I don't know what you think of that. I mean, you know, it's compelling public interest is obviously stronger, but, you know, what is compelling public importance? What is general public importance? But anyway, just, you know, I don't know if you've got any significance. Is I suppose, a higher test. I'm not sure which is higher between significant and compelling. But I don't know what you think of that. To both judges, what you think of that wording. I mean, as you say, I mean, we've taken the point of, I wasn't personally much in favour of changing the jurisdiction, but I've accepted it on the basis that, you know, they generally pick what they want to anyway, and so the wording of the Constitution may as well reflect that.
See, of course, if we give this wording, which is, I mean, it's appropriate, you should put in something like that, but don't forget at the moment it says they may not take them at all. And they take the cases that oughtn't to be taken. So what are you going to stop doing, you say, when you let them? You know, it's not, it's more, and I think you're right, I think they're right to do this in a statute of that kind. You're talking to the public on that, rather than to the judges. It's not going to make a great difference there. You're talking to the public. But that's an important thing to do in your laws. And you should be saying that's what that calls.
Just, it's 12 o'clock. The difficulty that I'm faced with is when it comes to the TSC and the Labour Appeal Court, those issues which we're really grappling with, I'm still grappling with those issues. They are weighty issues. They have huge implications for the FTA. We allowed Judge Dennis Davis a whole morning to address us on that. We've received a memorandum that is some compelling arguments, and I don't know whether we've been afforded enough time to engage with the judges on the issue, where we want to debate this provision next week already. I'm just putting what I find interesting, that there was a rebuttal to Judge Davis, that where dear John Lecker was sent back. Now, surely the ACA should, this has huge implications for the structure of our courts.
May I just say that, just Dennis Davis on this issue. Go and ask Dennis Davis who sits upon that court. Sometimes he gets judges from the High Court. So what is the thing about special?
I would have loved to hear Judge Chevalier much at greater length. But what I would like to ask him, on page 5 of the memo, he says it will provide us against in those areas of the law, or the court says, with a preferential right of appeal not afforded to other litigants, which may be constitutionally questionable. So, well, I understand that. But should one be doing that?
On the last point, the wording removing appeals to the FDA in certain states, or leaving it up in Act of Parliament, is the wording that was in the introduced bill. Okay, the wording that was distributed, that we had public hearings on and everything. So I don't know if it was a similar problem to what Judge Nugent has spoken about with judicial matters, but, you know, the FCA had the opportunity to comment. No, he was given a hearing because there was concern from people like you
that we should actually amend that provision in the introduced bill. Now, my problem is the SCA judges, and I suppose particularly to Judge Cataglia, as you're representing the court on this matter, is that why didn't the SCA feel so strongly about this matter, make representations? We've literally had to sort of drag a submission out of the court. Date 9th of November. This bill is a 2011 bill. It's been with us for some time. Our understanding is it was distributed. It was distributed at least to the heads of court, so to the president of the FCA. If you feel so strongly about this matter of the court, why have you not had representation strictly for?
Let me just say that the way this, I mean, as I understand it, the way this happened was the bill went to the head of court. At that point, Judge McCarthy didn't sort of think that this was a serious matter. He, in fact, personally doesn't even like to deal with labor matters in particular. So at that point, he let it go. Then he reported to a full meeting of the Supreme Court of Appeal, and that was the personal view that he had taken. It was then discussed properly in a full meeting of the Supreme Court of Appeal, and we thought that that was an incorrect approach. President Sarkozy then agreed with the rest of the court, and then asked us to prepare a memorandum, which he then supported. So I can't tell you, you know, I mean, I have no recollection of when the bill was first published or why it didn't come before us. But the fact of the matter is that it seems to have been considered by us late down the line, to the extent that we, there's been an oversight on our part, but we apologize for that. Excuse me. Yes, no, in fact, can I tell you that now I remember, when you visited us last November, Judge McCarthy was then on long leave. So in fact, he had not been aware at the time or at least he'd forgotten, because I think he was told, he actually forgotten about, you know, the submission that we made to you. I'm quite sure we dealt with the matter.
I raised it with the issue.
Whatever the situation is, you don't need a transcript. Look, what I've now given you is our view. If it comes too late, surely a parliamentarian, and you don't tell me how I put you by job, I said, tell you how you put it. But as parliamentarians, either our position is valid or is not valid. If it's valid, then even at this late on, you must see that it's reflected in the law. If it's not valid, you make a policy decision. But with respect, Honourable Jeffries, I think that to sort of to accept or reject the view because it's coming at the 11th hour, it's not a valid way.
It wasn't around, we won't accept it because it's coming late. It was a question of trying to work out if this really was important to you as the FBI. I must tell you, the oldest bill in the National Assembly.
But I can tell you that had it not been important, this I can assure you, we not been this husband memos to you if they are not carefully thought through. And I personally worked on that. And it was tabled, all the judges had looked at that and approved it. So I'm telling you, we're representing a view, a unanimous view, incidentally, of the Supreme Court.
I didn't object to it. I think just to remind you, what clearly of course it is Judge Cataglia himself who raised the question, where does this thing come from? Where does this thing come from? And I left that meeting with him. It was a study because I wasn't in a position to answer him. So clearly they had a pipe in mind. The fact that they haven't submitted memorandum to us, I'm thinking, okay. You said there was
The kinds of questions that Honourable Swart would raise. Then it's a matter of which politician, which minister is more persuasive. And I can tell you, when Minister Asma was around, he made everybody know that water was the most important thing in the country. So Water Court would have, and he is, as you all can remember, he was a very persuasive man. And so there may then be another policy debate about whether, you know, tax matters and other matters should be dealt with in the same way. That's why I say that outside of what we consider, what we look at ourselves and our own court, you must look at things systemically. Don't make decisions without unintended consequences and which cause come back to bite you from a policy point of view later on. I can't say more.
Say a few words. Justin Eugene, Justin Chamber, thank you for coming to us. Mightily appreciate your views will be I do tend to agree with Mr. Swartz that we would have preferred more time on the 17th Amendment, but it's just not possible. Right now.
The appointed procedure is governed by Section 193 of the Constitution. We are the Committee of Parliament, proportionally composed, blah, blah, blah. But there are other requirements, the public participation and so forth, which we've already begun to comply with by advertising, receiving and so forth. Now, I think the remaining part of that would be the fact that we must interview in public. What is our decision is how short the shortlist. But what I want to ask you is this, because I didn't look at, and I've seen four of these, not five. I didn't look again at the Public Sector Act. What is the eligibility provision in that Act? What is the disqualification provision, if any? So please remind me, because I mean, the eligibility requires what? 6 years, as a what kind of a... Okay. Now, have we satisfied ourselves that all of these persons comply with those requirements? That would be the first thing to do. And if anybody does not, they become excluded. For those that remain, we must decide how many we interview. There may be a case, there being so few, there may be a case saying we simply interview them all. But I think the first thing to do would be to exclude anyone who doesn't, in fact, meet the eligibility standards.
In the case of our Jeffrey?
I don't know if Friday or Monday.
Friday or Monday.
Yeah, in terms of possibility of getting into the House before we write.
Thank you.
Wayne doing. What I would suggest from following on Ms. Musk's point is that obviously, well, it's only five people. So I think if we have to interview five people, we can manage that rather than a long lens. Well, I haven't studied the issues. Obviously, if anybody is disqualified by not meeting the statutory requirement, then they should not be, included. There's no point in interviewing them. But otherwise, we'd interview who is here.
The point is that there's nothing you can do that a finalised and decided that it will be done by committee.
It's quite late notice in terms of, notifying. So I would, but it should be something. I don't know if any of the researchers but I think it needs to be gone through quickly, and then they need, if we are deciding whatever day we're deciding on, they need to be phoned today.
It sometimes happens that people quite simply aren't available. Okay, and would we be happy in that case with telephonic? I've frequently been part of such interviews where the person concerned is overseas and to do the telephonic interview. So that's your other, I would say we do that.
Assuming that these people have all five of them. I was thinking on Monday, but I understand the urgency, but I'm just worrying that all five will be available Friday. No. Very short notice. Monday.
Can we ask a few of our members, what if somebody is sort of self-evidently not eligible or appropriate? Yeah, somebody has to decide.
We're meeting again tomorrow. We're meeting today and tomorrow. Meeting tomorrow. Last Tuesday. Look, I was bad. There's that 10-year requirement in the Public Protector Act. Make sure that all five fit into the eligibility requirement. That's all requiring of you. All right. So we've agreed it'll be on Monday. And if all five fit the requirements, then we inform them. Well, I think all day. No? 14. What informs you must be 14? I'm so alive, but... Don't make him an hour. Start at 10. Are we okay with that? All right. Well, then, that's all we've done. Thank you very much. Yep.
The legal aid are coming at 9.
When?
to ask them for more detail. We've heard from the judges on their submission on the criminal procedure.
The person concerned was celebrating the Diwali today, and we believe that they will come tomorrow.
Maybe if we just got I think the choice we've got, either we go for the amendment or we don't. I mean, my compromise solution was ruled to be offensive, My compromise solution suggestion was ruled to be offensive, so I don't think it should really be on the table on the vote basis that you can't tell judges what to do, but it does seem to be that what's facing us is either the amendment as it's tabled or not. I don't think there's anything else I want to hear from other members.
Don't worry about them.